Double X is brought to you by Club W, leading the grape-to-glass wine revolution. Answer just 6 simple questions at clubw.com, and their algorithm will create a palate profile just for you. Get wine directly to your door, perfectly customized to match your taste. For 50% off your first order, go to clubw.com/XX. And also by The Great Courses Plus, a new video learning service with more than 5,000 lectures. As a member of The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many lectures as you want, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Sign up for a free 1-month trial by visiting thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX.
Hi, I'm Julie Lifcott-Hames, the host of Getting In. I'm the former dean of freshmen at Stanford and the author of How to Raise an Adult. Getting In is a new podcast from Panoply, following a group of high school seniors through the college admission process. And right now is crunch time, especially for students applying early decision.
You know, when you put it all together, it's a lot. I don't really sleep. I drink a lot of black coffee. But, you know, I'm stressed, but it could be worse. I could be bored.
That's what you'll hear on the new episode of Getting In from Panoply, available on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the Double X Gabfest for Thursday, October 29th, the Justin Trudeau's Luscious Locks edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate and The Atlantic, and I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And also Noreen Malone of New York Magazine.
Hi, Hannah.
So before we get going, we are still looking for an intern. If you're interested, please write us at doublexgabfest@slate.com and put in the subject line intern. We kind of need you to be in New York or D.C. for tapings, which happen Wednesday morning. So please specify if that's possible for you. Okay, let's jump right in. Our three topics. First, the notorious RBG. Why is this tiny opera-loving Supreme Court justice the object of so much love? We talk to the authors of a new book about it. Second, Justin Trudeau, the new Canadian PM. He is hot. Are we allowed to say that? Is that the wrong thing to say? Can we say that about male politicians, or is that lame? We will discuss. And the new novel Purity by Jonathan Franzen. Does he have hateful feelings towards all women or just his mother?
Cutting to the chase.
I have like more interesting things to say, but that's just the tease. Okay. Okay. All right. The notorious RBG, a.k.a. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a tiny but powerful Supreme Court justice, and also now a popular tattoo. A new book out by Shauna Knižnik and Erin Carmone explains how she became the object of so much fan love and kitsch adoration. Hi, guys.
Hi. Hello.
And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So here's what I'm really curious about. How do you go from being this figure, this powerful figure of jurisprudence, to this powerful figure of jurisprudence who's also an awesome silk screen, like Che Guevara? Like when like, is there, can we mark the time when that switch happened? Like, was there a moment when she said something or did something where everyone went, ooh, you know, we see her differently?
Well, I think it started in about 2013. There had been some images of her in popular culture before that, but what prompted me to start the blog was in 2013, a number of dissents that she wrote for cases involving employment discrimination, affirmative action, and then one in particular where the majority opinion struck down a major provision of the Voting Rights Act. So that was Shelby County v. Holder. And, you know, everyone was angry about these decisions that week. And Justice Ginsburg's words were sort of this light amidst all of the anger at where the court was going.
And was it the fact that she stood up and delivered that speech? Like, what was it that captured everybody's imagination?
I think that was part of it, absolutely. As we describe in the book, you know, it's very unusual for justices to read dissents aloud from the bench. And she did it 3 times that week, which is a Supreme Court record.
You also mentioned that she has a pretty sort of, not weak voice, weak isn't the right term, but a sort of a small voice right now, right?
Well, she's not a loud person. She is certainly more, you know, quiet in her everyday interactions, but certainly in her writing and when it counts, she can pack a verbal punch.
And I think part of it is that people want to find a hero for themselves who is not the intuitive hero. The very fact that she is quiet, restrained, doesn't draw attention to herself, and yet a close reading of her words yields a lot of force and strength of reason. It leads people to embrace her. It's kind of like a counterintuitive icon. We've been so excited to see, you know, people are all sharing on social media that they've gotten their books. The book only just came out, and we were saying it's almost a form of signaling. Someone saying, I'm a huge nerd, but I'm also having fun with this, and bringing together a kind of community between people who are nerding out about the Supreme Court, who have a particular approach to it, too, a kind of like democratic raucous. You mentioned the Che Guevara. There's a kind of visual iconography happening here that people are really sharing. That's key to the vernacular of the Internet and of feminism on the Internet.
Do you think something of it has to do with her literal physicality, too? Just she's a, you know, an older, frail looking woman. And then you find out that she can do how many push-ups is it?
20.
Well, 20.
Possibly more.
Yeah, actually, her trainer said he has to hold her back from doing more than 20 push-ups.
He has to tell her to take a break.
Yeah. So do you think women identify that with that in some way? I'm sort of assuming that the audience that you're talking about here is mostly women, but that might not
be true.
There
are some men on Instagram who wear the Notorious RBG shirt. But yeah, it's probably primarily women. I think definitely women are used to being underestimated, particularly young women who may be traditionally feminine. She's quite feminine in her presentation. She, married young. She was a mother. She was dismissed at every interval of her career, including recently. Basically, just her being a thin, you know, older woman, people assume that she's at death's door, intellectually and physically.
That's very dramatic. I hope no one ever says that about me.
What?
You are robust, Hannah.
I am robust. Thank you. Where does Notorious RBG come from? Whose idea was that?
So it was actually a friend of mine who posted on Facebook in response to Justice Ginsburg's dissents that week in 2013, in complimenting her writing, he said, wow, Justice Ginsburg sure can write, #NotoriousRBG. And it just clicked in my head and a light bulb went off that this had to be a thing. And I looked online. There wasn't a space on the internet dedicated to celebrating this amazing person. And obviously the humor is in the contrast between this small, you know, octogenarian with this, you know, larger than life hip hop figure who was killed before his 25th birthday. But, you know, that is exactly why people are so drawn to her, because she is not the person that you expect to be this larger than life figure.
Do you think she knows who the Notorious B.I.G. is?
Well, she knows now. She had to be told by her clerks, what's this Notorious, as she put it.
And then now she always says, well, we're both from Brooklyn.
One of the things that's really striking about the book is that there is both kind of, you know, the equivalent of 25 things to do with a jabot and sort of, as you said, close readings of her opinions and some of her dissents. Like, you actually annotate some of the stuff that she has written and said. And I kind of wondered why you wanted to combine those things. I suspect you may have gotten suggestions that you should either keep it light or make it real. Or am I wrong about that?
Well, no, I think that there's a certain skepticism or jadedness about the sort of blog-to-book genre. Shauna is a lawyer. I'm a journalist. These are subjects that we're seriously engaged in. We wanted to have fun with it because people responded to the humor and the irreverence of the meme. But the meme is already on the internet. This is a book. And we wanted to tell a story. We reported the story and spoke to many people in her life, her clerks, her colleagues, her family members, her grandchildren. And we wanted to have people understand that this is more than just a cool old lady. This is a serious intellectual who had a project to transform the law and to transform the world for women. And it worked. So that meant that we couldn't choose between the workout illustrations that we have in the book and the annotated dissents. And at certain points, there was sort of like, oh, do we need all this stuff about intersectionality? Oh, God, all this law stuff is kind of boring. But I think in the end, what we're hearing from people who are reading the book is that they see that as kind of the perfect encapsulation of the phenomenon, because the people who were drawn to her wanted to know more and wanted to go deeper. And that's what the book does that's different from the Tumblr.
But even the Tumblr, I'm just defending my own work. I think that the part of the project has always been this combination of substance and fun. And that's, you know, I was a law student at the time. Now I just found out that I passed the bar yesterday.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
That was quite a day, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. But, you know, it's always been about engaging with the work and bringing this the seriousness of what she's actually doing and what she's done throughout her career to a larger audience and making it okay for people who are not necessarily law nerds to understand what equal protection is at a broad level. And so I think that that's exactly what the project has always been about.
So you describe her jurisprudence as sort of incremental, and you had a Times op-ed this weekend. Do you think there's something inherently feminine about a more cautious, sort of slow burn of a jurisprudence as opposed to a just more aggressive sort of, you know, change the law overnight with this decision?
Well, you know, it's interesting because a friend of mine, Rebecca Traister, who's a feminist writer, said to me, you know, I think it's so fitting that women like Hillary and Ruth Bader Ginsburg are more incremental because they're the women that throughout the movement were the ones who were being asked to make coffee mm-hmm. and like make sure that there was, you know, paper in the printer or whatever they had back then. And so no wonder that they're not standing in the middle of the room declaiming romantically about how they're going to change the world. I also think that there is more space for someone to be a kind of radical revolutionary when they have other kinds of, you know, privilege or status. And she was someone who just her being in the room was considered shocking. You know, so she also, I think some of her incrementalism is just tactical. It's just her trying to get what she needs to get done in the way that she thinks is the most effective.
Yeah, and I think it's about meeting people halfway. Her visions, you know, her vision for equality and her ideals and her principles have always been somewhat radical. And even today, you know, these notions are not at all settled and are pretty, you know, idealistic in a lot of ways in terms of gender equality and stereotyping. But she's always gone about doing the work in a way that doesn't alienate people that may disagree with her. And I think that's partially tactical and it's partially just a part of her personality. She wants to bring people along with her, as she says.
I couldn't quite pin down how you guys feel about that strategy. Like, do you feel that it's outdated? Do you feel like it's something you fully admire? I couldn't pin that down entirely with the book.
Well, I'm ambivalent about the Roe critique because I think that it's been disproven. She basically critiques Roe v. Wade for not being grounded in equality and for going too far too fast. And I think that there's some pretty persuasive scholarship out there that equality arguments were presented to these nine guys and they weren't interested. And I'm not sure that that ever would have prevented a backlash from taking place. So I think it's sometimes to a fault. But I also think that, and this is something that I've written, I also think that we have such a hair-trigger political dialogue right now. I'm not one of these people that's like, let's all come together in bipartisanship, because I think, frankly, that there are certain radicalized elements out there that are not interested in working with other people. But I do think that her sort of deliberativeness and strategic usage of her anger is something that is worth emulating and worth at least considering if we can import it to our contemporary context.
And also, I think from the legal perspective, you know, it's not possible to just come into a courtroom and say, this is the way it should be. This is the law. And women are equal. Like, you know, a courtroom is not a protest. And you have to be strategic. You have to convince the judges or, you know, if it's a jury trial, you have to convince a jury that the law is actually on your side. So in her case, she was doing that. So incrementalism was really just a way to move the ball forward while still respecting precedent. You know, we think of feminism as sort of this idealistic thing where we're thinking about the way society could be, but at the same time, the law is all about precedent. So you have to move the ball forward step by step, and that's exactly what she did.
Well, there's so many great things in this book, like the pictures of her when she was younger. And
so gorgeous. Oh, my God.
So gorgeous. And also that her relationship with Scalia. This is my favorite thing about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is the curio about the Supreme Court that I can never get enough of. And also the letter you guys reproduced that she found on a legal pad that her husband wrote for her right before he died. You guys have just collected a tremendous number of really interesting things, and thank you for coming on the show to talk to us about them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That's the Notorious RBG, The Life and Times of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, out this week. Our second topic is Justin Trudeau and whether it's okay to objectify male politicians. But before we go there, let's hear from our first sponsor, Club W.
So I hate to admit that I don't know about some things, because basically I know everything except I know nothing about wine, which has always been an embarrassment to me, partly because I never know what to order or what to buy. So in a restaurant, I guess I order on the price. I go to the wine store or the liquor store and I'm looking at labels. So I've always figured that I'm missing out because of this. But then I discovered Club W. So Club W is this new wine club, and it's changed the way that I get wine. So you just go to clubw.com and answer 6 simple questions, and their algorithm creates a palate profile for you. They then send you wine directly to your door, and it's perfectly customized to match your taste. And you don't have to take their suggestions. You can pick wines also. So it's not kind of an automatic, this is the book that you will get. You're not obliged to get the wine that they pick. You can also choose, but they do help you in that way. Club W is leading the grape to glass wine revolution, which means they work directly with vineyards to cut out the middlemen, which saves you money. So with Club W, you get premium wine customized to your taste at a third of what you'd pay at the store. They even have a no-risk 100% guarantee that you'll love what they send you. So right now, Club W is offering our listeners 50% off your first order when you go to clubw.com/XX. That's DOUBLEX. So stop wasting time and money messing around at retail stores looking at labels and start drinking wine you know you're going to love. 50% off your first order when you go to clubw.com/XX.
All right, Justin Trudeau. He's a very serious, very admirable politician. He's pro-choice. He calls himself a feminist and he wants to legalize pot and tax the rich. He's basically Bernie Sanders, except not. In one important way. And none of us would know his name or care about the Canadian election. This is true if he did not look the way he looks. So instead, he started another conversation, which is it remotely socially acceptable to objectify male politicians when we get so annoyed when people do it to women? Maybe we should establish some things before we start this, because the Canadians are just pissed. Like, they think this is just, you know, a totally illegitimate conversation that we're having.
I don't know about that. They're so glad that we're paying attention. Personally, I love Canadian politics. But I know that anytime I tweet about Canadian politics, about 10 people tweet me back saying, oh, my God, we're so amazed that you're interested. Like, anybody who pays attention to this ginormous country that's right above us that has major resources and a decent economy, they freak out. So they're happy. I think we also need to point out, too, that even though we all get all in love with the Liberals because they have that name, they're not actually the most radical party in Canada. The NDP is actually more to the left, but still, their leader wasn't as hot as Justin.
Yeah, that was my question, was could he bring what Justin's bringing to the table? I had been ignoring headlines about the Canadian election for weeks.
They didn't exist. That's
no, not for weeks, but for like a couple days as it got close, there were headlines and I wasn't clicking. And then, you know, he won and I finally was like, all right, I'll click. I'll find out what the deal was there. And I just was like, wait. Is this a real picture of the candidate? And literally the first thing I did was I texted my sister, I think the new Canadian prime minister is hot, with like 8 question marks, just like puzzled by what was happening here. So that's my history with Justin Trudeau.
And did you feel guilty when you did that? Did you feel that you were violating some code of gender politics?
0%. I mean, listen, we are still working at a deficit of centuries of objectification. I would say that it is only in the post JFK, post Reagan era become okay to objectify male politicians.
Yeah, no, they love it. It is always okay. I mean, Kristen Gillibrand was on the New Yorker podcast, which was quite good. It's like a good variety show. I don't know if any of you listened to it. She was interviewed on the podcast and she talked about some of the stories that she tells in her book. And she tells one particular story about how when she was at a law firm, she was being appreciated for some reason. And her boss said, you're so smart, you work so hard, and you have a great haircut. And somehow that really cut her. Like, that really made her feel terrible. The great haircut kind of zoomed to the fore and everything else disappeared in her mind. And I feel like the difference with men is you objectify them, but it doesn't become the whole of their reputation or poison them or poison our views about them. So it is a little bit different.
I think it's different, too, in that we sometimes say positive things about attractive male politicians, but we really don't ever say anything about them being unattractive or looking old or having, mm-hmm. you know, we might, you know, there's some sort of so beside the point griping or fun making about Donald Trump's hair, but that's slightly different because I think that's more in the, it's not about his looks as much as his vanity. But people do talk about women's looks in the negative way, which I think is so much more poisonous. I mean, a woman politician knows, I think, at some level that people are going to be criticizing her looks. And I don't think people criticize men's looks. They just, you know, woohoo when they're hot, but they don't ever, you know, mumble about, you know, their poor bone structure or whatever.
What about Chris Christie's weight?
I think weight is a slightly separate thing from looks. And I think it's, I find it kind of admirable about Chris Christie that he, you know, just kind of blusters through and really ignores comments about his weight. And I think that it's striking. I can't think of any female politicians that have been overweight in the way that he is. I mean, it's unusual, I think, in general.
Yeah, and definitely not overweight in the way that he has. Although Kirsten Gillibrand, again, she had gained a little bit of baby weight, and she was really sort of shamed up and down for it. And she has spoken publicly, like she lost a whole bunch of weight, and the way she was treated in the media, I think, played into that. But on the question of physical fitness and candidates, male candidates, I will say that Martin O'Malley. If you Google Martin O'Malley, the second Google suggestion is like Martin O'Malley abs. well, I clicked, but it made me like him less. They were like, he has, you know, sort of an incredible body for, you know, however old he is, a man in his 50s, a man of any age, really. And it made me like him less because they were clearly such vanity muscles. Like, they were clearly just things he'd spent hours in the mirror looking at, feeling great about. They just were sort of like made for the camera. And I just felt like that was a window into his soul, or maybe the slight lack thereof, that did not make me like him better. So maybe I'm being, you know, a sexist jerk and calling him shallow for caring about his appearance. But I just had that total reaction.
That's maybe just your taste in men.
No, I know. It's, I mean, yes.
No, I share that taste. The excessive vanity is a turnoff for some people. It's a turnoff.
But in a politician, you know, don't you want him to be concerned with other matters and like what his biceps look like as he's...
But it's a metaphor for some kind of discipline and hard work. With Paul Ryan, I think people make a connection between his commitment to his workout and his commitment to fiscal responsibility. Those are somehow in the same box. The same way with Bill Clinton, it was a metaphor. His inability to control his appetite in all ways became a metaphor for his political style.
See, I think we only talk about politicians' looks when they aren't offering us anything else to talk about. So, for example, gay Twitter, and I must admit certain Slack channels on Slate, during the Democratic debate, the first one, there wasn't much to talk about in terms of like what was being said. So we were talking like, is Martin O'Malley hot? And, you know, as I said, gay Twitter was going crazy. And I think that if they had produced all kinds of interesting, you know, debate points, we wouldn't have gone there. And with Justin Trudeau, he has a reputation of being hot and of having great hair and of having that manly tattoo and having a good chest, which is suspiciously hairless. But he doesn't have a reputation as like an intellectual giant. So I suspect there's a little bit of compensatory like oohing and aahing. We don't ooh and aah over their ideas so we go with their chest.
Oh, man, that is giving like way too much credit to gay Twitter. You really think if there had been a really serious discussion about, you know, I don't know, the budget, that gay Twitter would have been alight about that?
Maybe if this it was is the like budget. No, you got me there.
That's interesting. I mean, I think you're right that probably no discussion of, you know, criminal justice reform would have stopped those admiring tweets. I mean, I remember, too, in the second Republican debate, there was a lot of discussion about a hot guy who was sitting behind, you know, the moderator. So yes, like, I guess it's just a thing. But
I want to be on gay Twitter. It sounds fun.
It sounds fun.
Is this just something that people do naturally and we can't help ourselves? You know, you look at politicians, you see them on the stage, even politicians, and you just kind of, the eye just naturally judges which one is good looking, which one isn't.
I think that the heart wants what the heart wants. I mean, I have to admit that the politicians that I find hot and I'm attracted to are not politicians that, generally speaking, that I would vote for. I've always had a thing for a kind of harsh Tory woman, like Jean Kirkpatrick. She was my first politician crush. Like, wow. She would be so harsh. I've always been like, I've always had a thing for like Sarah Palin, you know, Governor Fallon of Oklahoma, that whole like Michelle Bachmann, like all of those people, like, you know, they would be like really unforgiving, really bossy. But I would never vote for any of those people, but they're hot.
I think you should write Sarah. Like, you don't
know. I also think some of it is just we're not expecting to see anything attractive in that sphere. Like, you sort of flip on C-SPAN and you're like, all right, old white guy in a suit. Like, I might as well be at, you know, my dad's 50th high school reunion. But and then you flip it on and it's like Justin Trudeau's eyes. And there's just like, you know, even if Justin Trudeau were not exactly your cup of tea in this context, it's like, wow. Like, wow.
There was this tweet that said, visit Canada. The weather may be cold, but the president is hot. I don't know why. I just like laughed.
They don't
that
have
for
a president. Good God.
he's been a gift
this
to the internet.
Hilarious, stupid tweet. Yeah.
BuzzFeed did a whole really quite undignified listicle of photos of him like holding babies. And it ended with Justin Trudeau riding a horse and the BuzzFeed listicle article being like, I wish I were that horse. And then below that, there was like boilerplate text that was like, want a hot man in your inbox every day? Sign up for BuzzFeed's due today newsletter, which I did not do, but, you know, copied it down in case I wanted to think about that later. But yeah, the internet's really loved Justin Trudeau. And will this be good for him as a politician or not, June? Like, is he going to be really disappointing? I know very little.
Well, here's the thing, like, Canada has a parliamentary system. So yes, he's the leader of the Liberal Party, and so he's the Prime Minister. And, you know, we saw with Stephen Harper that there is a little bit of a cult of personality, but it's not a presidential system. So it's not going to be like taking his shirt off and dueling with Putin, you know. I mean, it's...
But do people take him less seriously in the way that women worry about when you comment on their looks and their good looks, that people will take you less seriously, so that Justin Trudeau has to walk into every meeting and tolerate, you know, 7 minutes of jokes about what's the latest thing that's been said about him on the internet before he can get to the thing that he actually
wants
to
accomplish?
Well, I
think with him specifically, there's also the meme, if you like, that he's... His fame derives from his father's genius, and that he's his father's son in certain ways. He's got a certain charisma. He's, you know, he's a second generation politician and all of that. But that he's, you know, a chip off the old block, but only a chip. He doesn't have his father's political intelligence, perhaps. And so, you know, there's that other judgment of, well...
And maybe that's a perfect storm, like being sort of your father's foppet and then being good looking. Those two things don't go well together.
Well, so he's got something to prove, which I think,
I think,
you know, Martin O'Malley, for instance, does not give off the air of someone who has a lot to prove. And so that has not served him well in this presidential election. But Justin Trudeau, you know, clearly he's a boxer. I feel like that exhibits some sort of like reservoir of anger. Maybe he'll take that to the parliament. Is that what they have up there, June?
Oh, boy. All right. That's enough of Trudeau. We'll be watching you, Justin Trudeau, to see what things you accomplish. And we'll be discussing them on a future podcast. Okay. Let's move on to Jonathan Franzen and women. But before that, we want to thank our next sponsor, Great Courses. We are big fans of the Great Courses. They let you learn at your own pace for the pure pleasure of it. That's why we're excited about something new from Great Courses, the Plus Video Learning Service. You get unlimited access to thousands of subjects. It has nearly 5,000 video lectures on history, science, photography, cooking, and many more things taught by award-winning professors, experts from National Geographic, the Smithsonian, and the Culinary Institute of America. With Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many lectures as you want anytime on your TV, laptop, tablet, or phone. Our listeners get a new introductory offer to try the Great Courses Plus free for 1 month. The Great Courses series, normally priced at $200 to $300, but you can get the unlimited access to the whole library completely free for 1 month if you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/XX. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/DOUBLEX. All right. Jonathan Franzen is the author of Freedom, The Corrections, and most recently, Purity. He's come to represent the great novelist, and sometimes in all the wrong ways, that is the great white male novelist, at least in social media. In his last book, the main character is a woman, and yet some of the other female characters seem to be animated by a seriously deep loathing of women. So that's what we want to discuss. June, thank you for reading this book. It is a sign that you love us tremendously.
I do.
And I just don't want that to go unnoticed. So thank you.
Appreciate that. Appreciate your appreciation.
It's a really long book. I'm so excited to talk about this topic. I've been looking for people to talk to about it. And then there's you guys. So that's great. First, can we get over the social media question? I'm actually not that interested in that. You know, how the fact that he gets on Time magazine and people label him the great white male novelist. Like, I just feel like that's not his fault.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
Totally.
Separate from the Jennifer Weiner argument, I'm not interested in that.
I mean, there is a way in which his fusty personality and whenever he does these interviews, he seems like a person of a slightly different century and he pretends not to be interested in social media, even though this book, Purity, is full of social media style references. But there's a way in which his personality comes across as patriarchal and irritating. But I also feel like that's not his fault. We're not having this conversation from the outside. I feel like he invites this conversation. This book, Purity, is centrally about the moment in gender animosity or relationships. That's a very explicit theme in this book. Like, I almost think purity refers to that, that the word purity is transferred onto men, that that's a word that was used to women, and now purity is something that men can never achieve and are constantly being scanned. And they're the ones who are born with this weight on their shoulders. They can never be pure.
So which character? So you think that the Andreas Wolf character is constantly seeking purity and he's the one who has this weight in his shoulders? Or
yeah, let's dive into this. Okay, let's just dive into it and enough with my theories. So yeah, Andreas Wolf says something like all men are born predators. I think that's his quote. So Andreas Wolf is the Julian Assange-like character who is at the center of this book. He's not the main character of the book. That is somebody actually named Purity. And by the way, before I continue, we are going to talk fully about this book. So if you haven't read it, you might want to skip this segment and come back to it after you've read all 800 some pages. And our producer, Anne Hepperman, may chime in and let you know where you should skip ahead to.
Okay, listeners, you can skip ahead to 44 minutes and 50 seconds to get to the recommendations.
Andreas Wolf, what did you guys make of him?
Well, I had an allergic reaction to this character, but I don't think it had anything to do with the kind of gender dynamics that we are talking about. I think it has to do with actually maybe a little bit of a different gender dynamic in Franzen's writing, which is that this character was the vehicle for Franzen's, quote, big ideas about the world. You know, he's has all these feelings about internet freedom and communism and all this stuff. And I just get so bored in Franzen's books when he starts doing this thing, which in my like two-bit analysis is just him trying to compete with the other, you know, great white male novelists, including, you know, David Foster Wallace, pretty most clearly to me. And I think it's like not a good mode for him to be in. And so I think he's much better.
Because the character gets flat for
it's
you?
Just like, it's so,
he
yeah.
just becomes a kind of a product of the current moment and not a person?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so Sam Tannenhaus wrote sort of a glowing review of this book in the New Republic about how this was Franzen's great gift, that he was fulfilling the promise of, you know, the novel to be able to incorporate philosophy and with social realism. And I think this is where Franzen falls flat, and it's just such a I don't know, the male ambition of it just bugs me in a way that, not bugs me, it just bores me, actually. And to me, this character is where it lives in this novel, and I just couldn't turn the pages away from him quickly enough.
Interesting. I mean, I didn't have quite that negative a reaction, and I was very interested in the specifically East German sections or the treatment of what it's like to grow up in a totalitarian regime as a son of privilege, as you know, Andreas's parents are. Well, his father is a minister in the regime, and his mother therefore has a sort of privileged teaching position. I found that interesting, but yeah, Andreas himself, not only because he was a sociopath or a psychopath or something, you know, there are a lot of unreliable narratives in different ways in Franzen's books and in this one especially. So the, what, six sections are each from a different point, a different character's point of view, and Andreas's section was the least interesting to me. But I guess I didn't hate him as much as you did, or want to keep turning the pages as much as you did.
So what do we make of the fact that the male characters are constantly having to make sacrifices, and in some cases extreme sacrifices, for women? They have, you know, Andreas has to murder somebody.
He doesn't have to, but he chooses to.
Exactly. He chooses to murder.
He suggests it, actually.
Yeah. He seems to have been getting out some feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that in turn leads to a lot of male rage. Like, there's a lot of rage in this novel against what women are turning men into.
Well, and so we should say Andreas has this very complicated relationship with his mother, which might be the keystone to the whole thing, right?
This is Franzen talked about that on a Terry Gross interview, his relationship with his mother. And it did seem there were definitely parallels. He admitted to parallels.
Yeah, he's talked about his relationship with his mother on two or three interviews that I've heard. And I think his mother is dead. I mean, in some ways, I hope. Like, that would be very difficult if she were just listening to this. But it does seem to be the key to his psychology and some of his character's psychology. He's also spoken about his sort of torturous relationship with his ex-wife, who is also a novelist who is less successful, certainly, than he was. And there is a character in this novel who, you know, a couple where both have artistic ambitions, and the man actually gets it done, and the woman literally goes nuts in the process of not getting it done. So he certainly seems to be drawing from life in some ways.
So should we talk about Annabelle? Because yes, she is the psycho character. One of our listeners, Thomas David Kehoe, wrote a very interesting email. He writes, "My sense is that Jonathan Franzen thinks that borderline personality disorder is normal for women." And I thought that was a really interesting thought, because Annabelle is, to the rest of us, you know, psycho, fairly extreme. And yet she has that spider quality. She keeps drawing her man into her web.
Well, we only see Annabelle, though, through the eyes of A, her ex-husband, and B, her sort of very slightly post-adolescent daughter, or maybe more than slightly post-adolescent daughter. But we don't really get Annabelle's own point of view. We just see how other people, who, if we think of them as stand-ins for Franzen with his complicated relationship with his ex-wife and his complicated relationship with his mother, you know, might have an agenda.
Yeah.
Right. So you think there is a possibility that he's pushing us to look at her as someone who is scripted by her father, her ex-husband, all these other people, but that she herself, there might be a core of sympathy there.
Well, I think he's saying, you know, people, he's making an argument, or just he's drawing a portrait within a portrait, you know, of the way people view someone else.
I'm very curious about what you made of Annabelle Hannah, because to me, I recognized that character, and I think that I've rarely seen that type of person or that type of relationship in literature, even though, like, I've experienced that kind of relationship where in some ways you're really drawn to someone, you become very dependent, you become, like, in a sense you allow them to control you, although you know it's actually you that's controlling you. You know, you're doing that to yourself, and you know that you're unhappy. You're making each other happy, that there's actually no joy in the relationship, but it's very hard to get out of it. And you do project, you know, mental instability onto that person often, and you behave yourself in a very crazy way. And I thought that was really well done. I'm uncomfortable. I understand why people are saying, oh my God, this is his picture of feminist, because he does associate her with a certain kind of feminism, but again, not from her point of view. And also for me, that's like, she apart from this weird dynamic that she has with the man that she marries and with her daughter, she is a very solitary person. She's an extreme person. And to me, that's like, that's her. Feminism is, by its nature, not a solitary pursuit. So
yeah, I don't think it's fair to associate her with feminism and say thus Franzen dislikes feminism. You know what's so interesting to me? Essentially, Karl Ove Knausgård, who I was reading this summer and talking about, has the same set of concerns and discussions about the ways that he's being forced to behave as a father and a man in a feminist society. And he's pretty angry about it. And yet he is beloved. and Franzen is so not beloved. And essentially, the characters go through a similar thing. I mean, as I agree with you, as a portrait of obsessive relationship, I think it's actually pretty convincing. That is definitely a type of personality. That's like Amy Winehouse and Blake Fielder. I mean, just to think of that is a type of relationship where two people are kind of drawn together and it's extremely destructive. It's like, well, I guess we call it the destructive relationship. But he is also working out bigger societal things, like Noreen said, like the enduring image of him, of this girlfriend forcing him because of her college-influenced feminism to pee sitting down.
Okay, you know? So but this is a joke. Like, he's a funny writer. And I feel like there was so much of the reaction to this took it fully in earnest that he was really making this castration argument about feminism. It was like a meta joke about the castration feminism, like, you know, I don't know. I just think he's more comic than people are always necessarily remembering when they talk about him in...
I don't really see his humor, I have to say. I hear other
well,
people...
Well, it doesn't mean he's funny, but he's comic. But, he meant to be comic.
Yeah, and I feel like that's my failure because when other people point out, like, oh my God, no, that was hilarious. That I'm like, oh, was it okay? Because I really enjoy reading him, but I don't find him funny.
Do you think, Noreen, he's playing this territory just to provoke this kind of conversation? Like, he wants the kind of earnest feminist response to his books.
No, I think he is. I think human beings have complicated responses to one another and complicated responses to gender. And I think he is trying to present as full and interesting a picture of that as possible. And I think that the filter of, like, does he hate women is kind of a shallow one that we're applying. I think a better one is, does he write interesting female characters who give me a new insight into the way that, you know, women and women interact and men and women interact? And I think the answer there is yes.
What did you think of Layla, the journalist, Hannah? I was really entranced by that section of the book and that, like, that discussion of reporting. As the one among us who's done the most reporting, how did you respond to that section?
You know, it seemed like a character from a different book. Like, she was written in realism, like in a different style. Uh-huh. And everybody else was written as an arch social type, you know. And she was written as an actual relatable person, you know, or that I thought, well, maybe he's just putting her there to show that he does have a range of women, like he knows better than to just have an Annabelle as the aging character in the book. So there's another one who's supposed to be kind of wry and knowing and a little hard ass, but also attractive, you know.
It's really striking, Hannah, how much Franzen, qua Franzen, the writer figure rather than the person who put this book together, is shaping your experience of the novel.
That's too bad, right? I didn't feel that way with Corrections or Freedom. His other books I didn't feel that way. And you actually don't want that, right? Like, you want the writer to sort of disappear as you're reading the book.
Which is weird because he's this, like, he's not a huge personality. He's sort of a quiet Midwesterner. I went pretty deep down the, like, Franzen, qua Franzen rabbit hole and read a bunch of interviews. Can I read you my favorite and I think very interesting quote from him? I can't remember where he gave this interview, but he said, which by the way jives with my own theory of Franzen's writing, which is that if he would just honestly embrace the side of him that is less male, more female, the sort of social novel, which, you know, when he talks about writers that he admires, it's often women. It's Edith Wharton, it's Paula Fox, it's these, you know, whatever. Anyway, so he told an interviewer, quote, I have many female parts, not physically. A personality is a collection of modules. There is no unitary I. Neuroscience, the ultimate authority on such matters, tells us that there is no unitary I. I think I've been cursed, but also sort of blessed with 12 different personality modules. Some of them are real girls. And I think that's so interesting that he wow. thinks of himself that way, and you can see it. And it's something he's, I think, fighting against sometimes and sometimes just like going for.
But it's so concrete the way he put it there, that there's actually a girl, one of them, some of them are girls. It sounds like they're actual voices in his head, not in a schizophrenic way, but that he feels these things to be beings which yeah. live inside him. That's really interesting.
It's so interesting.
Yeah. All right. In praise of imaginary beings, let's end it there. Thank you guys for talking about that book. Okay. Let's do recommendations. June, why don't you go first?
So I'm going to recommend something that was actually recommended to me by listeners to the podcast. Because my girlfriend doesn't really like television and I love television, I will watch whatever she likes. And so she likes sort of cozy mysteries. And when a listener recommended that I watch Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which is an Australian series that has three seasons available on Netflix, I thought that she might like it. And indeed, we have become Miss Fisher addicts, and we watch one or two episodes every night. And so they are set in Melbourne in 1928, and Phryne, who I can only say with an Australian accent, Phryne Fisher, is a really kind of, it's not terribly believable that such a woman would have existed in 1928, but she's very open-minded, she's very sexual, she's very pro-sex. She would be your best friend now in 2015 with her attitudes. But the mysteries are decent, and she's awesome, and she's so stylish, and she's kind of set up a whole household, mostly of women, but not exclusively. I really recommend Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries with the lovely Essie Davis as the star.
I think there should be a reality show about your couch.
With my cat as the main
character. Is one called, like, The Big Couch, right, where people just watch other people watching reality TV. So I feel like that should be about you.
In England, there's a show called Gogglebox, which lots of people watch, which is exactly that, people watching television and reacting to things that they're watching on television.
Wait, really?
Really. And it's relatively successful.
Wow.
All right, my turn. I am so much more highbrow than that. No, I'm going to recommend Lauren Redness's new book, Thunder and Lightning, which I just love. Every time a Lauren Redness book comes out, her last one was Pierre and Marie Curie. Because we talked about the RBG book, which is a collection of photographs and writing, Lauren Redness is the most beautiful visual feast. So this one's about weather, actually, and the history of weather and just images related to weather. And it's such a beautiful and satisfying book. So that's Lauren Redness. Noreen.
I have two articles to recommend. The first is related to our Franzen discussion. His girlfriend is also a writer and editor. Her name is Catherine Chetkovich. And maybe 10 or 15 years ago, after the corrections had come out, she published an essay in Granta. Is it Granta or Granta?
Well, it depends where you're from.
Granta. I'm from the Midwest, like Franzen. Anyway, it's called Envy. And she wrote about the feeling of being in a relationship where, you know, you're both kind of doing the same thing. And then all of a sudden, one person just skyrockets ahead, and the mix of you know, at some points for her, very poisonous sort of jealousy and then admiration and attraction and just all the social situations, going to lunch with the publisher. And she's a really good writer, like a really good writer. And this is a very finely wrought essay. And then the second is also a magazine article by our friend Dan Ingber, who
that was so good.
Yes. It's called The Strange Case of Anna Stubblefield in the New York Times Magazine, and it's a very complicated story of a woman who was a professor and activist who got in this. Initially, with a disabled man, she, you know, sort of began helping him.
It began as a therapeutic relationship.
Exactly. She was helping him to communicate with the world, but via this method that it turns out is very controversial, and whether she was sort of, you know, essentially moving the Ouija board to make it seem as if he were saying these things. Anyway, she
ended up entering into a sexual relationship with him, which is when things really took a turn. And Dan just explored this so expertly, and I can't stop thinking about the story. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't yet read it, go find it.
All right. Thank you to our producer, Anne Heberman, to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Our intern is Jesse Chasen Tabor. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out the entire roster at itunes.com/Panoply. To learn more about the show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Send us comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. You can also recommend topics we should talk about and react to the show. And our email is XXGabFest@slate.com. You can subscribe on iTunes so other people hear about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will talk to you in 2 weeks. Come on. Sicker than your average, pop a twist cabbage off instinct. Niggas don't think shit, stink pink gators. My Detroit players, Tim's for my hooligans in Brooklyn. That's dead right, if the head right, Biggie there, and I. Papa been smooth since days of under.